You're listening to Aperitivo, first broadcast on the 20th of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Aperitivo, brought to you by the Glenlivet. Hello from Midori House in London and welcome to Aperitivo, our new addition to the Monocle 24 lineup, coming to you live from Studio One and just down the road from the Monocle Cafe. I'm Andrew Tuck on today's show.
A handshake between the Iranian President Rouhani and Barack Obama would really break the ice between the two countries, would represent a step in the right direction.
Iran's president is heading to New York and a meet and greet with Obama isn't out of the question. Gavin McFadgen and Rachel Sharby ask what's in a handshake. Then we meet Brazilian architect Marcio Kogan, who talks with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about how to make their hometown of Sao Paulo a bit more livable.
It seems that nothing works, violent, very bad urban design, but I love it very much. You feel the energy. And sometimes I think this is the personality of the city.
And as every day on Aperitivo, we'll be stopping by at the Monocle Cafe for coffee and conversation. Today, we meet the founder of one of the world's most important design events, the London Design Festival.
London is the home of design education. You know, we've got a 150-year history. This is where it all started after the Great Exhibition. And so design is embedded in the very nature of the city.
More with Sir John Sorrell in a bit. Also ahead, music, a look ahead to the rest of the day here on Monocle 24, and much, much more. That's Aperitivo right now with me, Andrew Tuck. So, as you can hear, a huge amount coming up here on Aperitivo. But before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Syria's deputy prime minister says the civil war has reached a stalemate with neither side strong enough to win. Kadril Jamils has said that Damascus would call for a ceasefire with the armed opposition at proposed peace talks in Geneva. Meanwhile, the United States has called on the UN Security Council to act over Syria's chemical weapons. Secretary of State John Kerry called on the council to pass a binding resolution when it meets next week.
Time is short. Let's not spend time debating what we already know. Instead, we have to recognize that the world is watching to see whether we can avert military action and achieve through peaceful means even more than what those military strikes promised.
Israel has said that a U.S. television interview in which Iranian President Hassan Rouhani pledged that Tehran would never develop nuclear weapons was an Iranian attempt to deceive the world. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev said that Rouhani's words were designed to deceive.
The simple fact is that Iran continues to enrich uranium, continues to move aggressively forward to have a nuclear weapon, and this must stop. We don't need words, we need action. We need the Iranians to stop enriching uranium. We need them to stop moving forward on plutonium. And until they stop this reckless path to a nuclear weapon, the international community has to keep the pressure on.
Tokyo Governor Naoki Inoue has said today that the Fukushima Daiichi plant was not entirely under control, less than 2 weeks after his city won the right to host the 2020 Summer Olympics. The plant's operator has said hundreds of tons of radioactive water are pouring into the Pacific Ocean each day and is struggling to contain leaks. The International Monetary Fund has urged US policymakers to support major reforms at the global lender and bury political differences over the budget to ease risk to the economy and markets. IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde said the reforms will give the global financial institution more money to prevent and resolve crises.
Let me say that while we are seeing some signs of recovery, global growth remained subdued. But the story is more complex. You know, back 6 months ago, we were talking about a three-speed recovery. Well, it's getting a bit more complex than just three speeds. There seems to be multiple speeds at work in a multiple series of transitions.
As many as 12 people have been injured in a park in Chicago, including a three-year-old child. According to a report this week by the FBI, the city has been torn by gun violence in recent years, with more than 500 murders in 2012. James Mungonvan is from the local police department.
Today we received a call for multiple gunshots in the park. When we arrived, the first company requested an EMS Plan 1, which upgraded the amount of ambulances that came into the area. Once we assessed the situation, it was upgraded to an EMS Plan 2, which allowed 10 ambulances total to come in here. We had multiple victims shot, which were transported to various hospitals throughout the city.
And finally, staying in the States, authorities in the New York town of Shirley have found 850 snakes, including two illegal 6-foot-long Burmese pythons, in the home and garage of an animal control officer suspected of dealing in the reptiles. Officers raided the home and have published a photograph of the officers holding the pythons. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. I don't like snakes.
I hate snakes. They're horrible.
We agree on something for once. So 800 of them.
850.
Do we know how big they were?
Two of them were 6 foot long Burmese pythons.
How do you fit those all into a garage?
I've no idea.
Okay, well, we'll leave that image. Now, you're going to be back with us in half an hour, and we look forward to that. But for now, thank you, Jonathan. And everyone, you're listening to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24, and we're going to be right back after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tóquio. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Londres.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai Monocle, vada se che che che.
From London,
London. London, cara.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Aperitivo. The time is now 2:07 a.m. in Tokyo. It's 18:07 here in London, and it's 13:07 in New York. It's time now for us to take a fresh look at the top stories around the world today. And joining me here in the studio is Gavin McFadgen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism in London, and Rachel Sharby, journalist and author of the book Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to be looking at the unfolding events in the Middle East today. An extraordinary number of headlines to keep up. And I know you're both journalists, you're both watching what's been happening in the media. Rachel, for you, we're going to pick up on what Israel has been saying as well. But just watching the news, has it been interesting to see the Israeli line, for example, coming out and how we kind of read this rapid manoeuvring in the last couple of days?
Yeah, I mean, one of the American diplomats apparently described it as a head-spinning week in terms of diplomacy and the Middle East. And certainly, the rapid twists and turns have been quite extraordinary and very interesting to keep up with, because now it seems like we have this miracle opening in diplomacy, something that seemed unthinkable just a couple of weeks ago when, the drums of war were beating around Syria and it seemed like, it was attack or nothing, as though those were the only two choices we ever had. And suddenly the Russians have, I think, played a hand really well and opened up a line for diplomacy, allowing Obama to say, well, yeah, that sounds all right. That sounds like it could work, referring to Syria giving up its chemical weapons stash. But that in turn has opened up all sorts of other potentials and areas of interest in the region, notably with Iran. And the overtures now towards Iran in a kind of two-way flow are partly because of what's happened with Syria, so that instead of threatening to attack Iran's biggest ally in the region, Syria, the fact that the US is now looking for ways out of the situation has created possibilities for Iran to not only become involved in that Syria diplomatic effort, which the US has always refused the possibility of happening, but has also created its own overtures between Iran and the US.
Gavin, I want to pick up on this later on in the programme, but what's also funny is just how all the media are trying to have to kind of get their, as we said, it's been a bit of a head spin. They can't quite get even round their heads who Rouhani is at the moment. They had him painted as one person. The idea of who he is changing by the moment. And you see the old talking heads being dragged onto Fox News and things, and they can't quite keep up with events. For you watching this, has it been a bit extraordinary to see how we try and talk about a guy like Rouhani. Even the words like moderate don't seem right. It's just difficult to pin him down at the moment.
Well, I think they're looking for strategic cliches to apply. And there aren't very many here. It's like a mad dance in an orchestra hall without an orchestra and people running around bumping into each other. And I think one of the stories that we don't read much about, which is fascinates me, is the role of the U.S. military, particularly in relation to Iran and Syria. Because we were reading in sophisticated magazines in the last month that a lot of generals were opposed to a military intervention. They thought it as counterproductive, was too expensive. And then, of course, with Iran playing a softer card and the Russians gaining some credibility, as everybody says, outside of the United States. In the States, of course, the line is that Putin is an arch manipulator and this is some sinister underground thing that he's pulling off. But he actually was quite a brilliant move because he backfooted the United States for the first time since 30 years. The United States has to play second fiddle to Mr. Putin. I think it's astonishing. Well, meanwhile, the generals are very happy because they don't have a war to fight.
There's a huge amount here I want to unpick with you, but there's something that we've put together that we want to play to you both and our audience first of all. Because today, as we're saying, all pundits and diplomats are looking ahead to Midtown Manhattan, where Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, will address the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday. The Iranian version of Cold War Kremlinologists are all keeping eyes and ears on public announcements from Tehran and the White House. Will Rouhani and Barack Obama meet in a corridor by the water cooler or the vending machine? Maybe sit down even for a coffee. It would be the first meeting between a US president and an Iranian counterpart since 1977, when Jimmy Carter met the Shah. If such a meeting did happen, what would be its significance? Gavin and Rachel, I'm going to come back to you in a second, as I said. But first, we asked a few Iran watchers to give us a grading for the meeting, if it does happen, from 1 to 10 in terms of its significance. And here's this report.
A handshake that is recorded for posterity, I would probably give that a 7 out of 10, something that's symbolic and an important gesture, although, diplomacy is full of gestures and full of symbolism. So I think in that sense, I would give it a 7, but I hope it would be something that could then lead to things much more substantive. A meeting would certainly be towards 9 or 10, to be honest, if a meeting between Obama and Rouhani took place, but I have to say I don't see it happening at this stage.
I think a handshake between President Obama and President Rouhani would be very, very significant indeed. You have to remember that for 30 years, Iran and America had no relations whatsoever. To have a physical meeting from the head of state of the US and the second most powerful person in the Islamic Republic is indeed significant, and I'd give it an 8 out of 10.
On the scale of 1 to 10, I would say it's 7. Why? It would break the ice between the United States and Iran. The relationship between the two countries has been institutionalized in terms of hostility in the last 35 years. It would represent a step in the right direction between two reformist and liberal-minded presidents. In fact, it might help in resolving the Syrian conflict. So all in all, it would be a very powerful and symbolic gesture between the Iranian President Rouhani and the American President Barack Obama. A handshake really is basically vintage world diplomacy now. A meeting would be a plus. A scheduling another meeting in the future would really represent the beginning of a rapprochement between Iran and the United States. What we need to understand is that hostility between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States has been institutionalized in the last 35 years. A handshake between the Iranian President Rouhani and Barack Obama would really break the ice between the two countries, would represent a step in the right direction. No one is suggesting that somehow this would be it, but it would basically, in the eyes of Iranians and Americans, would be symbolically very powerful.
And that, in order, was Ali Ansari, the founding director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at St. Andrews University. David Patrick Karakos, author of Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State. And Fawaz Jerges, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. Rachel, does a handshake matter?
Yeah, a handshake matters. It was interesting the last few days reading what some Iranians have been saying about the situation, and really that kind of sense of bated breath, thinking, wow, could this be the end of a period that has been so depressing and so repressive for us? You know, people are talking about years of the political repression, you know, arrest of key political opposition figures, you know, shutdown of internet access, and the kind of just feeling disconnected from the world and also being kind of painted as a pariah state of the world. And this kind of sense of expectation that that might end, and especially in the last few days with the sort of the changes that the Iranian regime has made, the release of political activists, the temporary freeing up of Facebook, and these overtures to the states, this very nice editorial in the Washington Post the other day from Rouhani. And it just, I mean, I think in Iranian eyes, you know, of course, to some degree, the handshake is going to be a handshake with the devil, right? The American devil, as it has been for the past three decades. But in terms of what it could mean for Iranians on the street, I think it is really significant, yes.
And Gavin, when you look at what's unfolding, what's interesting is that the Americans have an extraordinary opportunity. They were kind of out of the game 5 days ago. It seemed, you know, everything had gone badly wrong. Now Rouhani is kind of actually kind of throwing them a bit of a lifeline. If they can sort this out, but fraught with danger, because, you know, if, you know, we don't know whether Rouhani's kind of telling the truth when he says he doesn't want a nuclear weapon, and we don't know whether he would be wrong-footed at home by the mullahs. We just don't quite know exactly. Do you think we can believe what he's saying?
I think there's a tit-for-tat. And about 4 or 5 days ago, there was news in the States that the National Security Archive at the University of Maryland was releasing for the first time with the full sanction of the CIA all the documents proving the CIA's complicity in the murder of Mossadegh and the overthrow of an elected president of that country, which was used by subsequent Iranians to justify their anger against the United States. It was the thing that was always pulled out and to which there was always a resounding total silence from Langley, Virginia, and from Washington about what everybody knew they had done. Now they've openly admitted it. And that, I think, was part of a game that must have been being played and behind the scenes before. You admit that, we'll admit some things. There'll be a give and a take. And so I'm glad it's happened. Nobody wants missiles pointed at each other. But I think that's the probable cause of doing that. And I think, as I was mentioning earlier, I think it's the generals who are pushing that agenda rather more than the politicians. Politicians are only comfortable not with initiatives, but by repeating themselves.
Ray, should you get a sense that the kind of the push is oddly coming from Tehran? It's not coming really from Washington. Washington does, again, seem to be slightly on the, it's responding to Rouhani. There's something that's happened in Tehran, even their engagement with the use of Western newspapers to kind of get their message across. We know that Rouhani came to university here at Glasgow in the United Kingdom. He's, you know, he's not somebody who doesn't know the West. He knows it very well. Are we seeing a real thawing, the kind of the beginning of something that, you know, potentially a kind of an Iranian Gorbachev?
Yeah, it's quite amusing to see this kind of lineup of hostile world leaders use American newspaper op-ed columns. I mean, I quite like this development. I hope we see a lot more of it. But no, I think that we're trying, you know, the last week everybody's been trying to get Rouhani. You know, why is he so open? Is it because he's been Western educated? Is it this? Is it that? Maybe he just is. And also, maybe it's just a geopolitical shift in the circumstances. Russia has actually been instrumental in opening up this pathway for Iran. Iran has always wanted to be a part of the negotiations over Syria. Russia has wanted that too. Russia has consistently said, look, it's nonsensical for one of Syria's main allies, Iran, to not be involved in this negotiated solution. By the way, a negotiated solution is the only way out of the Syrian conflict. It's completely stalemated. Neither side can overwhelm the other. Only talks will end the bloodshed. And up until now, the US has consistently refused. But because Russia now has the upper hand diplomatically, because it's played this strategically very clever game, it has opened up a pathway for the US, giving it a get out. And also, by default, or by design, I don't know, created an opportunity for Iran to now make these same overtures to the US.
Now, we're going to move on in a moment to the subject of Syria, but it's just worth quickly quoting something from the Washington Post. This is where Rouhani was writing, and you just realise, if he's correct and if he's telling the truth, how much things are different to what we've been read. He says that more than a decade and two wars after 9/11, Al-Qaeda and other militant extremists continue to wreak havoc. So he makes it clear that where he stands on the issue. And he also makes it clear that in Syria, he is not naming who's responsible for these attacks. You know, he's just saying there were chemical attacks. So just quickly before we move on, Gavin, again, you know, we really do have to pick these stories apart, and but this is signed off text that's been gone over many times in the foreign ministry in Tehran. There must be something really important in here, don't you think?
I think there probably is. I mean, again, I think it's part of a give and take between Washington and Tehran, and this we're seeing the outcome of it, and it's a progressive outcome if it doesn't end in shooting. I think it's slightly disturbing as an external journalist watching this process that the very people who are so exercised about sarin gas and about all the rest of it, legitimately, I don't say it's illegitimate, are the very people who've sold and are the largest world producers of sarin gas. It's like the baby bomblets that kill more thousands of children around the world than any other single weapon are made by the United States and Britain. And yet that's part of the dilemma, that you sense a hypocrisy in some of it. It's a little hard to take, but I take the point.
Good. Well, both of you stay there because we're going to come back to you in a moment. You're listening to Imperativo here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. I'm joined today by Gavin McFadgen, the director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism, Rachel Sharby, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. We're going to take a short break now, and when we return, we'll move from New York and Iran to Syria, looking into our crystal ball at the end game of the civil war in that country. Stay tuned.
The Glenlivet was the first single malt to successfully cross the Atlantic Ocean. And since that first journey, the world-renowned whiskey has never looked back. Now, master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting their global community of whiskey connoisseurs, the guardians of the Glenlivet, to help create their next limited edition whiskey. To discover more and write the next chapter of the legacy, join the guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet. The single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
From Mali to Martinique, every 4 years, the best athletes from the French-speaking world gather for the Francophone Games. Monocle's Steve Blomfield reports from Nice on the event, which, for the French, is about more than simply sport.
The Gabonese table tennis team is filming every second, ready to send all the footage home. The Armenians cheer on their wrestlers as if they were competing at the Olympics. Chad versus Cote d'Ivoire in the wrestling, Haiti versus Lebanon in the football. None of these are a clash of the titans, but watching a Chadian wrestler thump his chest in celebration as the buzzer goes, hearing the cry of anguish from a Djiboutian table tennis player as he loses a tight set, this means something.
You can watch Steve Blomfield's sporting report and over 350 more films on monocle.com.
And welcome back to Aperitivo here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Gavin McFadgen and Rachel Sharby. We're moving on now to Syria, where the civil war has perhaps seen in recent days hints of a kind of end game. For the first time, a member of the Syrian government has agreed that perhaps neither side in the conflict has what it takes to win. The country's deputy prime minister, Kadri Jamil, has said his government could perhaps call for a ceasefire if talks in Geneva could be arranged. So is this progress? A bit earlier today on Monocle 24, we heard from Karen Lee, the managing editor of Syria Deeply, an independent digital media project focused on that crisis. Here's what Karen had to say.
It's important to note that there's a history of ceasefires, a long history of attempted ceasefires in Syria. The Arab League has tried a couple of times. The UN and Kofi Annan have tried. And it always disintegrates once you get to the table. There's always way too many factors, different people wanting different things. Nobody can agree on anything. And this is really going to depend on getting the right players from the opposition, the right players from the regime, to sit down and come to an agreement that works for both of them. And that's a huge hurdle. It's a lot to ask, especially at this point. But I think the regime's really on this campaign of damage control the last couple of weeks. They've agreed to the Russian-U.S. plan. They're coming out saying this now. I think they're trying to say, look, we're making concessions. But whether those concessions are going to have any effect on the dynamic on the ground or the outcome of the war, it's very unlikely to me. I'd be surprised.
So, Rachel, do you think a ceasefire could be on the cards?
I think this is a very interesting development in terms of, I think, possibly the Syrian regime is just putting that out there to kind of gauge, get the sort of international reaction. And it's already gone global. Everybody is talking about this, you know, the Syrian regime talking about a stalemate. So possibly it's just testing the waters. And I think what's happened probably is that Syria's allies are starting to pressure it. Russia and Iran are starting to say, look, you got to find a way out of this because we're not going to support you forever. And at the same time, while the Assad regime is saying that, we also have the Syrian opposition because of the splintered nature of the opposition, because so much of the most significant or certainly the most militarily strong components of that opposition are Al-Qaeda affiliates. That are now clashing with the Syrian opposition. The opposition, the moderate, the Free Syrian Army, is saying, look, we can't fight them and the Assad regime. This is like a civil war within a civil war situation. So perhaps the opposition is now reaching the same conclusion, which is, by the way, the conclusion that analysts have reached for some time, that the situation is completely stalemated, that one side cannot overwhelm the other, and that the only way out of this bloodshed is a negotiated solution. So it might be the case that both sides are actually reaching that conclusion at the same time. And now it's up to the international community and, you know, the backers of both sides to bring them to the negotiating table on those terms, which is something that hasn't happened until this point.
Because, Gavin, what's interesting is, you know, oddly, the Russians haven't had much to lose up to now. You know, they've just had to say no, no, no. Now they've kind of staked some credibility on this. They've kind of said, look, you know, this is the way forward. This is the path. If Assad doesn't meet these deadlines of revealing what he has in his chemical arsenal, then suddenly they're in a kind of a tricky position. So do you think behind the scenes, actually, some of this talk probably does come from Moscow saying, look, you know, we've stepped in once to help you out. Now you've got to start helping us.
I think that's probably right. And that's exactly what's going down. And there's a lot of arms trading as well, because the Russians are the chief arms supplier in Syria, as well as, curiously, the Americans. And so the two have a lot of leverage on that regime in a curious sort of way. But if you look at all the infantry and the military vehicles, a large number are Russian. And if they stop the spare parts and the flow of ammunition, that regime could be partially crippled. Similarly, the United States is supplying weapons to the Al-Qaeda people. I mean, the whole thing is a swamp of conflicting loyalties and all the rest of it. It's very hard. I mean, Reggie, you may have an idea about how that all plays out. But it's not clear to me what the end game can be in that circumstance.
Well, I think that's been one of the problems. The main problem with this conflict all along has been that what started off as quite a genuine uprising, people's uprising against a brutal dictatorship, very quickly evolved because it turned into this proxy war with, you know, different countries cynically using Syrian blood for their own agenda. You know, the US allied with Qatar and the Saudi Arabians, seeing this as an opportunity to dismantle this kind of Shia axis in the region and the lash out at not just Syria, but also its allies, Iran and Hezbollah. The Russians also having their own agendas in supporting the Assad regime. So everybody has had an interest in this game. And unfortunately, nobody's interest has been the Syrian people.
And the idea of a ceasefire is all well and good, though, but we don't know what that would really entail, because you have a ceasefire, but if Assad stays in power, then it's going to be kind of impossible for the people who are on the opposition side to ever really accept that. Do we think there's any chance of Assad going? He seems to be, you know, oddly holed up rather well. He's survived all this time. The game is kind of running in his direction for the last few months. Ceasefire, fine. But is there a kind of a peace settlement in there, possible in there? What do you think, Evan?
I think if he offers a correct solution to the problem of the Free Syrian Army, that becomes possible. Because they're the only ones in the opposition camp who are modernists, who believe that women shouldn't be subjected to things and all the rest of it. So he has a natural ally in some respects in that camp, just as elements of the Ba'athists in Iraq did with the modernist middle class. And you find this very strange collision of cultures and values. And the money is all over the place. But where it's not is Al-Qaeda, because that's entirely foreign supported. Mm. So you have a very strict war possible between the Free Syrian Army and Al-Qaeda, which the Americans would love to jump in, probably. So it's a very complex situation.
But I agree that, up until now, of course, the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, has said, well, we're not going to sit at any negotiating table unless it is presupposed that the outcome is the removal of Bashar al-Assad. And, that has been supported by the US and, the allies of the FSA, which I think is a mistake, because obviously the regime does have to stay in some shape or form. And as unpalatable as that may seem to us, that has to be a reality in Syria. There is no other way that the bloodshed will end unless it's some sort of power-sharing agreement between the two. And as long as the international community encourages the FSA to think that it doesn't need to go down that road, the bloodshed is going to continue.
Now, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you both. We head into this weekend, an extraordinary weekend, with the diplomatic sands shifting, perhaps like not for many, many years. So Gavin Mfadjen, director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism, and Rachel Sharby, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. Thank you very much for joining us here on Madrid House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo to Buenos Aires
to Zurich, to Hong Kong,
to Toronto,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Well, plenty still to come in the second half of today's aperitivo. We're going to head to the Monocle Cafe for a chat with Sir John Sorrell. We'll talk Brazilian architecture and we'll preview what's coming up on today's Globalist Asia and the Monocle Daily. Before that, then, there's Jonathan Wheatley with all the world news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. Syria's Deputy Prime Minister says the civil war has reached a stalemate with neither side strong enough to win. Kadri Jamal has said that Damascus would call for a ceasefire with the armed opposition at proposed peace talks in Geneva. Israel has said that a US television interview in which the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani pledged that Tehran would never develop nuclear weapons was an Iranian attempt to deceive the world. The Tokyo governor has said today that the Fukushima Daiichi plant was not entirely under control, less than a fortnight or 2 weeks after his city won the right to host the 2020 Summer Olympics. The plant's operator has said hundreds of tons of radioactive water are pouring into the Pacific Ocean every day and it is struggling to contain the leaks. And the International Monetary Fund has urged US policymakers to support major reforms at the global lender and bury political differences over the budget to ease risk to the economy and markets. The IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde said the reforms will give the global financial institution more money to prevent and resolve crises. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. He didn't give us any snake stories this time, but no, there was no. I thought it was going to be some other strange beast at the end of your broadcast, but no.
Well, probably we'll wait for 10 o'clock.
OK, I shall stay here for another 4 hours just to find out if there are any more critters sneaking into the news. Thank you very much, Jonathan. And welcome back to Aperitivo. It's currently now 18.33 here in London, which means it's 21.33 in Moscow and 13.33 in Rio de Janeiro. Now, each day on Aperitivo, we'll be leaving Studio One here at Midori House and heading over to the Monocle Cafe just around the corner on Chiltern Street. In today's show, we meet Sir John Sorrell, the chairman of London Design Festival, which ends on Sunday. In John's 40-year career, he's also created one of Europe's biggest and most successful design businesses and served a stint as UK business ambassador. John met up with Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, at the cafe to chat about how the festival has evolved over its decade-long run.
Oh, the festival's changed enormously in terms of scale and in terms of its international audience. So 11 years ago when we started, there were 40 events in London. There are now hundreds, way over 300, and we think about 400,000 visitors, 60,000 people from abroad. So it's much, much bigger. But also, I think the quality's gone up, and often that doesn't happen when you get scale, but I think that's the case.
What are your favourite events coming up over the next couple of days? What are you most excited about seeing? There's a lot to see.
Well, of course, it started last weekend and it runs through to the end of the coming weekend. Some of the things I've seen which I would really recommend. I went to the opening of Endless Stair, which is this extraordinary structure sitting outside Tate Modern. And Bardaxo-Reich and by Clark of Arup. It is a magnificent piece technically, but also it's so much fun. And if you climb it, you get these great views across the Thames and over to St Paul's. And it's based on an Isha drawing. So it's about 15 interlocked staircases, which don't go anywhere except to this, up to this viewing platform. Enormous fun. I would also very definitely recommend going to the V&A, Victorian Albert Museum, which is packed full of different installations for the festival, including a 30-metre-long chandelier by Omar Arbel, which I think is the longest, biggest chandelier creation in this country for 100 years. And that's just inside the entrance. Just walk in, look up. Brilliant.
Wow.
And then there's the big blockbuster, the big showcase trade shows, 100% Design Junction tent and all those. But I think you have to discover for yourself. And I would recommend look at the website, get hold of the guide. The guide's about an inch thick. There's so much in it. And plan your program.
And of course, last night was the Design Oscars.
Design Oscars, great. Thank you. I like that phrase. I love it. The London Design Medal. Well, it's seventh year of the medal. And it was absolutely wonderful evening. It was very special. The medal went to the London Design Medal went to Peter Saville, and the Lifetime Achievement Award went to Dieter Rams, who came over from Germany to accept it. And it was wonderful because we sat Dieter opposite Terence Conran, who received that same award last year.
Wow!
They're exact contemporaries. They know each other, and I was very privileged to talk to Dieter a little bit, and I was absolutely fascinated. Because I asked him what his hobbies were. You know, people think, you know, great designers like him don't have hobbies. They think just designing beautiful watches and furniture. Do you know what he loves? He loves gardening, and he does bonsai trees.
Really?
He's got as he says, it's not a Japanese garden, but it's a European version of a Japanese garden, and nobody else is allowed to clip his bonsais.
Well, a man of such precision,
Can you imagine how beautiful that must be? And we gave the Design Entrepreneur Award to David Constantine, who is another extraordinary man, I think a genius, and who, you know, I've known David for a very long time, and, you know, he says, well, I try to help people who are worse off than I am. Well, goodness me, he's a hero of mine too. So it was a fantastic evening, and it followed on from the other Oscars, as you call them, over the years, and I think it's now very... It's a sort of very desirable award.
And how important is it, or how much of a factor is it, that London is the sort of the production hub as well? This is where all the students are, the studios where, you know, young little designers are setting up shop, which doesn't happen to a lot of the other design capitals.
London is the home of design education. You know, we've got a 150-year history. This is where it all started after the Great Exhibition. And so design is embedded in the very nature of the city. I'm chairman of University of the Arts London, so we've got 18,000 students in London. Lots of those are from abroad, and you again get this extraordinary international mix. People come here to study, and they stay and they set up their business. But also lots of people come here from other countries to make this their home and to set up their business, because they think this is the most creative community in the world. And if you're a creative person, you've got to be in a creative community. You can't operate otherwise. So I'm incredibly lucky because I've watched this happen. It wasn't like this when I was a young man, you know, starting out as a designer when I was 19. Uh-huh. It's completely different. But that is so exciting. And I don't know another city in the world that is like that.
Yeah. I'm sort of thinking about the other 51 weeks of the year. What is the sort of design industry like at the moment in London?
Well, the design industry is not immune from recession. Mm. I've been through about five during my career. But the point about the design industry, it's always at the forefront of regeneration.
Yeah.
Because everyone in the end goes to designers, whatever discipline, to create the new ideas which are going to get them out of the recession and make them more money.
Yeah.
So the design industry is always a few steps in front of the game. And I'm looking around now, talking to people, and I can see some very definite signs that people are, you know, doing a bit better than they were last year, and that's a bit better than the year before. There was a very difficult period 3-4 years ago where there were a lot of redundancies and a lot of people in trouble. I think that's changing, and I think it's because in the end you've got to turn to design, because how else can you differentiate? Only one can be the cheapest, and you're certainly not going to win by putting thousands more people on a job. The only way you can be better and be best is to design.
Get everything on this show. Bonsai trimming indeed. Well, that was Sir John Sorrell, chairman and founder of London Design Festival, speaking with Monocle's design editor, and he's Tom Morris. Up next, we'll stick with design and get a taste of Brazilian architecture. That's on Aperitivo. Stay tuned.
Inspiring the likes of Charles Dickens since 1824, the Glenlivet may be the definitive Speyside single malt whiskey, but that's just one chapter of the story. Master distiller Alan Winchester is inviting the Glenlivet's global community of whiskey connoisseurs to help curate the flavors of their next limited edition whiskey, The Guardian's Chapter. To discover more, join the Guardians at theglenlivet.com. The Glenlivet, the single malt that started it all. Enjoy responsibly.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
And welcome back to Aperitivo with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, earlier today, renowned Brazilian architect Marcio Kogan met fellow Brazilian and Monocle team member, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, to discuss, among other things, the fact that Kogan is shortlisted for the key LEAF Architectural Awards. The ceremony will be held tonight, so good luck to him. Kogan also helped design Monocle favourite, the Fasano Hotel in Sao Paulo. Fernando and Kogan also discussed some solutions to make their hometown a little bit more livable.
It began when I was around 15 years old, and I was a very, very bad student in the school, and I was cutting class. Began to rain. I entered in a movie theater to protect from this rain, and I saw a film that I didn't know that what's going on in the cinema. And I saw the film The Silence by Ingmar Bergman. And this film changed completely my life, because I saw what happened in my childhood, that I had a very sad moment. I had problems in my family. My father died when I was 8 years old. And the film was, I understood the word art at that moment. And it changed my life. After 3 years, I directed a short film. The next 10 years, more 12. In the same moment, I was studying architecture. And I didn't know at that moment if I would be an architect or a filmmaker. And in 1988, I directed a long feature film. And at that moment, I had the office for maybe 5 or 7 years. And I was completely bankrupted because it was very expensive, and the film industry in Brazil was, that moment in the beginning, maybe now it's different. And I decided at that moment, after this film, to be an architect.
I'm sure you would be a good filmmaker, but I'm glad you choose architecture again, because you did wonderful things. And actually, you're here in London. What brings you to London?
Well, the Design Week, and we have an award ceremony of the LEAF Awards.
For which building were you shortlisted? I know the award ceremony is tonight, and it's I've seen pictures of MM House. It looks wonderful.
Yeah, the MM House, and also a photographic, professional photographic studio. It's the second one we designed. This one is the small one.
Can you describe the building to us? I mean, for those who haven't seen the pictures yet, and where is it, and what was your main inspiration for it?
The MM House is, I think, the main thing. It's a green roof in the traditional design of a house, but covered by grass. It's a long, long, very wide project. And it's a little bit an influence from the films, because...
Again, the films.
Yeah, I created the widescreen eye.
And can you tell us about, I mean, for those who don't know your work as well, about your projects? I mean, for example, you helped design the Fasano Hotel, which is an iconic beauty in São Paulo and a Monaco favorite as well.
Yes, I designed the Fasano with Isai maybe 15 years ago. And it's a project that's a little bit different than we usually do because it's more traditional, more classic. Maybe the office is more modern, but I like it very much.
Can you give us a sneak preview of your next projects?
Okay. One very interesting project that we're doing now, it's our first public building, a project with the Teatro Municipal from Rio de Janeiro. That's a very classic, a kind of opera theater. It's the central of production, a school of technicians. We're doing a joint venture with the Aliscala in Milan and probably with the Royal Opera House.
Wonderful. That looks very interesting.
Yeah, because they have here in London the similar project, the backstage of Royal Opera House that we visited a few months ago and stayed there for one day.
And you mentioned that it was one of your first public buildings. I want to talk about cities as well. We're both from São Paulo. I mean, I believe we both love São Paulo as well. Yeah. But you have to admit, sometimes it can feel a bit chaotic. You as a very renowned architect in Brazil and in São Paulo, do you see a solution for the city to improve the quality of life in the city itself?
For me, São Paulo's question of love and hate very interesting because the city is very chaotic, a huge pollution, awful buildings. It seems that nothing work, violent, very bad urban design, but I love it. I love it very much. You feel the energy. And sometimes I think this is the personality of the city. No planning. And it's a completely who against the urbanism laws. It's very interesting in this sense.
Does it work?
I don't have advice to the city.
You don't have advice?
No.
And before we started the interview, we were discussing even we're in London now, which I believe is a city that you like. Do you see some similarities between São Paulo and London?
I think in the sense of energy, it's a very creative city, and I think São Paulo is the same. I think it's a big similarity.
Well, that was Marcio Kogan with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And we're going to have some music now. And we're going to keep things Brazilian. Because this is Seu with Cordão da Insônia. Well, that was Seu with Cordão da Insônia. That's not bad, is it? Now, we're fast approaching the end of the show here on Monocle 24. But before we say goodbye, I'm joined in the studio by the producer of this evening's Globalist Asia, Tom Lewis, and also Marcus Hippie, who's going to be presenting the Monocle Daily. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
You've become like a new kind of double act here on Monocle 24.
We have become close friends this week, yes. Sharing so much time together. It's been a nice week to have.
Well, it's been very nice to have you. You've been a regular booking here on Aperitivo. Now, Tom, first of all, Globalist Asia, tell us... what's going to be your lead?
Well, we've got a jam-packed show. We always like to squeeze things in. We're leading with, all this week, obviously, on the Globalist Asia, we've brought you a series looking ahead to Germany's elections on Sunday. So tonight we're going to round the whole thing up. We're going to have two live guests who will be speaking to us live from Berlin. And we'll also just be tapping on some of the themes and unpicking them a little further. Some of the themes we've discussed throughout the week. So we'll be looking at the impact of the youth vote in Germany. We'll also be looking and asking why this campaign has been looked upon from Europe as quite an important one, but inside Germany it's widely seen as a pretty dull campaign. So we're going to be asking why that's the case and actually what's in it for the rest of us come Sunday's vote.
Well, we've been looking at Greece all week and the fact that, you know, that some people worry that that country could teeter towards, you know, civil war. And then the fact is that Germany could, you know, ease the purse strings and perhaps change, you know, what happens in that country. So all across Europe, we're incredibly concerned about the outcome and what it means for Europe and the world.
Absolutely. And I think where the uncertainty is, I mean, the latest poll by the ZDF TV station puts Angela Merkel's party at around 40% support. So it looks like that some coalition will need to be formed afterwards. And that's where the nuance comes into play, really. No one really knows how the smaller parties, the other potential coalition members, will do on election day. So, you know, Sunday will be the vote, all eyes will be on Germany. But actually, I think it'll be the weeks ahead when actually the fate of Europe, if you like, will really be hammered out with the nature of the coalition that comes to be.
Now, Marcus, we've been looking at the top of the show about the heading to the UN of the Iranian president, but he's not the only one heading for New York. And you're going to be looking at some of the logistics around the meeting next week.
It is quite interesting considering how many world leaders are actually heading to New York during those days. And when you think of one world leader, someone important coming to the city, it often means that part of airspace needs to be shut down. So when we're thinking of all these people coming in, the question arises about how they're actually dealing with the logistics. When it comes to airplanes, when it comes to where the planes are being put when they land at JFK or wherever they land, and how these world leaders are actually being taken to the central New York, to Manhattan, all that. We're looking forward to if we are going to experience delays in New York and how much preparation work all this massive project is going to take. And we also obviously talk about what's coming up in the assembly, what are going to be the issues dominating the agenda.
Now, it's also another quite serious story that you've got before we go to the more entertaining things on your list. You're going to also be looking at a strange kind of entry into the machinations of the... Oh, you've got one more thing to add, have you?
I was going to add that. I had a great introduction for this. I was going to ask from you, Andrew,
okay,
that if you were a Chinese woman, what could make you buy beer?
If I was a Chinese woman, what made me buy beer? I don't have to be a Chinese woman to be made to buy beer. I'll happily get you a beer afterwards, Marcus. Is that what you're feeling? I need to be dragged by you a bit. No, tell me.
If you were a Chinese woman, if you saw beer that's being branded with Hello Kitty characters, would you go and buy?
I think maybe not for me, but you see, I'm finding it hard to channel my inner Chinese woman. But tell me, why are you asking this question?
Because that's relevant, because actually that beer is actually coming to sale in China. So indeed, you see beer cans over there gradually, and they have got Hello Kitty characters. And that's the new strategy, trying to make Chinese women drink that beer.
Now, I did see a flight today. I must check that out for you. There's the first Hello Kitty flight. There's a flight that took off today as an airline. We might find out that while we're talking to you. Only Hello Kitty on the plane. It's kind of like every video is Hello Kitty. It's for adults.
The world domination of Hello Kitty is pretty
extraordinary. I don't understand Hello Kitty.
It baffles me too, I'll be quite honest. I mean, there was a big story in Singapore, wasn't there, I think, a couple of months ago, where the sort of craze outside this new store, I think, that opened was something that Singapore had never seen before, but it had captured the imagination in all kinds of ways.
And Marcus, if you were a Chinese woman, would you be drinking Hello Kitty?
I've been trying to think about this the whole day. I always close my eyes and I'm trying to be a Chinese woman.
Probably the best way of doing it,
I think I would try.
Now, I was going to try and speak to Tom about Jordan and Chinese politics, but I don't think we can dare go there now.
I think it is a bit of a
step back, if I can put it that way.
Well, listen, let me sort of meet Marcus eye to eye with the light story of the day. We'll be checking in, as we like to do, with one of our correspondents in the Americas. Tonight it's Barrett Austin, who's our correspondent in the southern United States. You were asking Jonathan Wheatley, Andrew, a little earlier about an animal story, why there were none in the bulletin. So Barrett Austin, he has stepped up to the plate. Apparently Alabama is grappling with a raccoon crisis. It's been a thorn in its side for a while. They don't really know how to do it, how to sort of solve the problem. And it's becoming these little sort of a nibbly issue, if you like, for many residents across Alabama.
Now, our editor chief may be lying, but Tyler Brulé told me that actually a raccoon has like proper little hands with little thumbs on. So if they get in your house, they turn the taps on. They can do that.
That's absolutely amazing.
So you're popping down for your midnight cup of tea. That would be quite a sight.
Yeah, they're kind of with the kettle already. They're stirring their coffee.
Frying the eggs in the morning.
could you give me a biscuit, do you mind, while I'm here? No, but apparently they're very clever at getting into the house, and then they turn the taps on, they flood your house.
Well, that's what the residents of Alabama have been grappling with.
So there's Barrett too many of
us. Yes, essentially. So Barrett will be bringing us the latest of how the authorities
look. Marcus, he's from Finland. They don't even have raccoons there.
No, we
don't. And he's going to have an opinion now on raccoon hunting.
But I just want to say that the Monocle Daily's got another light item. Ha! Huh. We're going to be making a phone call to Sao Paulo to get great tips on how to spend your Friday evening over there if you happen to be going there anytime soon.
And how would you spend your Friday evening, Marcus?
With a raccoon. You'd invite a raccoon round.
With a bottle of Hello Kitty beer.
If you were a Chinese woman going to Sao Paulo,
would you take a raccoon with you or a bottle of Hello Kitty beer?
And can I just tell you, I've researched while we've been on air. So it's Hello Kitty fans in Taiwan. There was the first flight from Taiwan to America that's all Hello Kitty. How about that?
Brings tears to the eyes.
I think, Marcus, I see a trip ahead for you.
You pay?
Well, I'll pay as long as you drink some Chinese beer.
Deal.
With the Hello Kitty on it. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. And they have been a star turn this week here on Aperitivo. And that's all we'd have on today's Aperitivo. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Gavin McFadgen, the director at the Centre for Investigative Journalism, and Rachel Sharby, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands. We talked through the significance of a potential meeting between Barack Obama and Iran's President Rouhani at the United Nations next week. Here's what Rachel had to say. OK, I'm afraid I'm being told we don't have that clip. So today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Alexa Firmanich, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next up is our weekly food and drink show, The Menu, presented by Marcus Hippie. Today, Marcus speaks to Chef Elena Azrak. We'll also hear about the man who set up a restaurant in Istanbul dedicated to helping Syrian exiles feel more at home. And he's also going to be speaking to the king of Lebanese cuisine in London, Tony Kitous.
Inside me, I have a lot of happiness because obviously I created something and people come to you. And I want these people to come and just try the Lebanese food. It's almost like I really want to introduce Lebanese food to the people that actually don't know Lebanese food. I'll welcome the opportunity to have other people that have the same passion as me about Lebanese food, Middle Eastern culture, to do the same. Because the more people do it, the more popular Lebanese food and Middle Eastern food becomes.
Aperitivo is going to be back on Monday, but for now, Andrew Tuck says goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.